It was a pathetic attempt to salvage his dignity, but Joanne had the grace to pretend to believe him. "Then we both did something a little foolish, and we should just forget it," she said. "Yeah," said Woody, looking away. They were outside the factory now. Those at the head of the march stopped at the gates, and someone began to make a speech through a bullhorn. Looking more closely, Woody saw that the speaker was a local union organizer, Brian Hall. Woody's father knew and liked the man. At some time in the dim past, they had worked together to resolve a strike. The rear of the procession kept coming forward, and a crush developed across the width of the street. The factory police were keeping the entrance clear, though the gates were shut. Woody now saw that they were armed with police-type nightsticks. One of them was shouting, "Stay away from the gate! This is private property!" Woody lifted his camera and took a picture. But the people at the front were being pushed forward by those behind. Woody took Joanne's arm and tried to steer her away from the focus of tension. However, it was difficult. The crowd was dense now, and no one wanted to move out of the way. Against his will, Woody found himself edging closer to the factory gate, and the guards with nightsticks. "This is not a good situation," he said to Joanne, but she was flushed with excitement. "Those bastards can't keep us back," she cried. A man next to her shouted, "Right, damn right!" The crowd was still 10 yards or more from the gate, but just the same, the guards unnecessarily began to push demonstrators away. Woody took a photograph. Brian Hall had been yelling into his bullhorn about boss thugs, and pointing an accusing finger at the factory police. Now he changed his tune and began to call for calm. "Move away from the gates, please, brothers," he said. "Move back! No rough stuff!" Woody saw a woman pushed by a guard hard enough to make her stumble. She did not fall over, but she cried out, and the man with her said to the guard, "Hey, buddy, take it easy, will you? Are you trying to start something?" the guard said challengingly. The woman yelled, "Just stop shoving!" "Move back! Move back!" the guard shouted. He raised his nightstick. The woman screamed. As the nightstick came down, Woody took a picture. Joanne said, "The son of a bitch hit that woman!" She stepped forward, but most of the crowd began to move in the opposite direction, away from the factory. As they turned, the guards came after them, shoving, kicking, and lashing out with their truncheons. Brian Hall said, "There is no need for violence. Factory police, step back. Do not use your clubs." Then his bullhorn was knocked out of his hands by a guard. Some of the younger men fought back. Half a dozen real policemen moved into the crowd. They did nothing to restrain the factory police, but began to arrest anyone fighting back. The guard who had started the fracas fell to the ground, and two demonstrators started kicking him. Woody took a picture. Joanne was screaming with fury. She threw herself at a guard and scratched his face. He put out a hand to shove her away. Accidentally, or otherwise, the heel of his hand connected sharply with her nose. She fell back with blood coming from her nostrils. The guard raised his nightstick. Woody grabbed her by the waist and jerked her back. The stick missed her. "Come on!" Woody yelled at her. "We have to get out of here." The blow to her face had deflated her fury, and she offered no resistance as he half pulled, half carried her away from the gates as fast as he could, his camera swinging on the strap around his neck. The crowd was panicking now, people falling over and others trampling them as everyone tried to flee. Woody was taller than most, and he managed to keep himself and Joanne upright. They fought their way through the crush, staying just ahead of the nightsticks. At last, the crowd thinned out. Joanne detached herself from his grasp, and they both began to run. The noise of the fight receded behind them. They turned a couple of corners and, a minute later, found themselves on a deserted street of factories and warehouses, all closed on Sunday. They slowed to a walk, catching their breath. Joanne began to laugh.
"That was so exciting," she said.
Woody could not share her enthusiasm. "It was nasty," he said, "and it could have got worse." He had rescued her, and he half hoped that might cause her to change her mind about dating him. But she did not feel she owed him much.
"Oh, come on," she said in a tone of disparagement. "Nobody died."
Those guards deliberately provoked a riot.
Of course they did. Peshkov wants to make Union members look bad.
Well, we know the truth. Woody tapped his camera, and I can prove it. They walked half a mile. Then Woody saw a cruising cab and hailed it. He gave the driver the address of the Ruzrock family home. Sitting in the back of the taxi, he took a handkerchief from his pocket. I don't want to bring you home to your father looking like this, he said. He unfolded the white cotton square and gently dabbed at the blood on her upper lip. It was an intimate act, and he found it sexy, but she did not indulge him for long. After a second, she said, I've got it. She took the handkerchief from his grasp and cleaned herself up.
How's that?
You've missed a bit, he lied. He took the handkerchief back. Her mouth was wide. She had even white teeth, and her lips were enchantingly full. He pretended there was something under her lower lip. He wiped it gently, then said, Better.
Thanks.
She looked at him with an odd expression, half fond, half annoyed. She knew he had been lying about the blood on her chin, he guessed, and she was not sure whether to be cross with him or not. The cab halted outside her house.
Don't come in,
she said. I'm going to lie to my parents about where I've been, and I don't want you blabbing the truth. Woody reckoned he was probably the more discreet of the two of them, but he did not say so. I'll call you later.
Okay.
She got out of the taxi and walked up the driveway with a perfunctory wave.
She's a doll, said the driver. Too old for you, though.
Take me to Delaware Avenue, Woody said. He gave the number and the cross street. He was not going to talk about Joanne to a goddamn cabbie. He pondered his rejection. He should not have been surprised. Everyone from his brother to the taxi driver said he was too young for her. All the same, it hurt. He felt as if he did not know what to do with his life now. How would he get through the rest of the day? Back at home, his parents were taking their ritual Sunday afternoon nap. Chuck believed that was when they had sex. Chuck himself had gone swimming with a bunch of friends, according to Betty. Woody went into the darkroom and developed the film from his camera. He ran warm water into the basin to bring the chemicals to the ideal temperature, then put the film into a black bag to transfer it into a light trap tank. It was a lengthy process that required patience, but he was happy to sit in the dark and think about Joanne. Their being together during a riot had not made her fall in love with him, but it had certainly brought them closer. He felt sure she was at least growing to like him more and more. Maybe her rejection was not final. Perhaps he should keep trying. He certainly had no interest in any other girls. When his timer rang, he transferred the film into a stop bath to halt the chemical reaction, then to a bath of fixer to make the image permanent. Finally, he washed and dried his film and looked at the negative black and white images on the reel. He thought they were pretty good. He cut the film into frames, then put the first into the enlarger. He laid a sheet of 10x8 photographic paper on the base of the enlarger, turned on the light, and exposed the paper to the negative image while he counted seconds. Then he put the paper into an open bath of developer. This was the best part of the process. Slowly the white paper began to show patches of gray, and the image he had photographed began to appear. It always seemed to him like a miracle. The first print showed a Negro and a white man, both in Sunday suits and hats, holding a banner that said, Brotherhood, in large letters. When the image was clear, he moved the paper to a bath of fixer, then washed it and dried it. He printed all the shots he had taken, took them out into the light, and laid them out on the dining room table. He was pleased. They were vivid, active pictures that clearly showed a sequence of events. When he heard his parents moving about upstairs, he called his mother. She had been a journalist before she married, and she still wrote books and magazine articles.
What do you think? He asked her.
She studied them thoughtfully with her one eye. After a while, she said,
I think they're good. You should take them to a newspaper.
Really? He said. He began to feel excited.
Which paper?
They're all conservative, unfortunately. Maybe the Buffalo Sentinel.
The editor is Peter Hoyle. He's been there since God was a boy. He knows your father well. He'll probably see you.
When should I show him the photos?
Now. The march is hot news. It will be in all tomorrow's papers. They need the pictures tonight.
Woody was energized.
All right,
he said. He picked up the glossy sheets and shuffled them into a neat stack. His mother produced a cardboard folder from Papa's study. Woody kissed her and left the house. He caught a bus downtown. The front entrance of the Sentinel office was closed, and he suffered a moment of dismay. But he reasoned that reporters must be able to get in and out today if they were to produce a Monday morning paper, and sure enough, he found a side entrance.
I have some photographs for Mr. Hoyle, he said to a man sitting inside the door, and he was directed upstairs.
He found the editor's office, a secretary took his name, and a minute later he was shaking hands with Peter Hoyle. The editor was a tall, imposing man with white hair and a black mustache. He appeared to be finishing a meeting with a younger colleague. He spoke loudly, as if shouting over the noise of a printing press.
The hit-and-run driver story is fine, but the intro stinks, Jack, he said with a dismissive hand on the man's shoulder, moving him to the door. Put a new nose on it. Move the mere statement to later and start with crippled children.
Jack left, and Hoyle turned to Woody.
What have you got, kid?
He said without preamble.
I was at the march today.
You mean the riot?
It wasn't a riot until the factory guards started hitting women with their clubs.
I hear the marchers tried to break into the factory, and the guards repelled them.
It's not true, sir, and the photos prove it.
Show me.
Woody had arranged them in order while sitting on the bus. He put the first down on the editor's desk.
It started peacefully.
Hoyle pushed the photograph aside.
That's nothing, he said.
Woody brought out a picture taken at the factory.
The guards were waiting at the gate. You can see their nightsticks.
His next picture had been taken when the shoving started. The marchers were at least 10 yards from the gate, so there was no need for the guards to try to move them back. It was a deliberate provocation.
Okay, said Hoyle,
and he did not push the pictures aside. Woody brought out his best shot, a guard using a truncheon to beat a woman.
I saw this whole incident, Woody said. All the woman did was tell him to stop shoving her, and he hit her like this.
Good picture, said Hoyle. Any more?
One, said Woody. Most of the marchers ran away as soon as the fighting began, but a few fought back.
He showed Hoyle the photograph of two demonstrators kicking a guard on the ground. These men retaliated against the guard who hit the woman.
You did a good job, young doer, said Hoyle.
He sat at his desk and pulled a form from a tray.
$20, okay?
You mean you're going to print my photographs?
I assume that's why you brought them here.
Yes, sir. Thank you. $20 is okay. I mean, fine. I mean, plenty.
Hoyle scribbled on the form and signed it.
Take this to the cashier. My secretary will tell you where to go.
The phone on the desk rang. The editor picked it up and barked, Hoyle! Woody gathered he was dismissed and left the room. He was elated. The payment was amazing, but he was more thrilled that the newspaper would use his photos. He followed the secretary's directions to a little room with a counter and a teller's window and got his $20. Then he went home in a taxi. His parents were delighted by his coup, and even his brother seemed pleased. Over dinner, Grandmama said, As long as you don't consider journalism as a career, that would be lowering. In fact, Woody had been thinking that he might take up news photography instead of politics, and he was surprised to learn that his grandmother disapproved. His mother smiled and said, But Ursula, dear, I was a journalist.
That's different. You're a girl, Grandmama replied. Woodrow must become a man of distinction, like his father and grandfather before him.
Mother did not take offense at this. She was fond of Grandmama and listened with amused tolerance to her pronouncements of orthodoxy. However, Chuck resented the traditional focus on the elder son. He said, And what must I become, chopped liver?
Don't be vulgar, Charles, said Grandmama, having the last word as usual.
That night, Woody lay awake a long time. He could hardly wait to see his photos in the paper. He felt the way he had as a kid on Christmas Eve. His longing for the morning kept him from sleep. He thought about Joanne. She was wrong to think him too young. He was right for her. She liked him. They had a lot in common, and she had enjoyed the kiss. He still thought he might win her heart. He fell asleep at last, and when he woke it was daylight. He put on a dressing gown over his pajamas and ran downstairs. Joe, the butler, always went out early to buy the newspapers, and they were already laid out on the side table in the breakfast room. Woody's parents were there, his father eating scrambled eggs, his mother sipping coffee. Woody picked up the Sentinel. His work was on the front page, but it was not what he expected. They had used only one of his shots, the last. It showed a factory guard lying on the ground being kicked by two workers. The headline was, "Metal Strikers Riot."
"Oh, no," he said.
He read the report with incredulity. It said that marchers had attempted to break into the factory and had been bravely repelled by the factory police, several of whom had suffered minor injuries. The behavior of the workers was condemned by the mayor, the chief of police, and Lev Peshkov. At the foot of the article, like an afterthought, union spokesman Brian Hall was quoted as denying the story and blaming the guards for the violence. Woody put the newspaper in front of his mother. "I told Hoyle that the guards started the riot, and I gave him the pictures to prove it," he said angrily. "Why would he print the opposite of the truth?"
"Because he's a conservative," she said.
"Newspapers are supposed to tell the truth," Woody said, his voice rising with furious indignation.
"They can't just make up lies."
"Yes, they can," she said.
"But it's not fair."
"Welcome to the real world," said his mother. 6. Greg Peshkov and his father were in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C. when they ran into Dave Ruzrock. Dave was wearing a white suit and a straw hat. He glared at them with hatred. Lev greeted him, but he turned away contemptuously without answering. Greg knew why. Dave had been losing money all summer, because Ruzrock theaters were not able to get first-run hit movies, and Dave must have guessed that Lev was somehow responsible. Last week Lev had offered Dave $4 million for his movie houses, half the original bid, and Dave had again refused. "The price is dropping, Dave," Lev had warned him. Now Greg said, "I wonder what he's doing here." "He's meeting with Sol Starr. He's going to ask why Sol won't give him good movies." Lev obviously knew all about it. "What will Mr. Starr do?" "String him along." Greg marveled at his father's ability to know everything and stay on top of a changing situation. He was always ahead of the game. They rode up in the elevator. This was the first time Greg had visited his father's permanent suite at the hotel. His mother, Marka, had never been here. Lev spent a lot of time in Washington because the government was forever interfering with the movie business. Men who considered themselves to be moral leaders got very agitated about what was shown on the big screen, and they put pressure on the government to censor pictures. Lev saw this as a negotiation. He saw life as a negotiation, and his constant aim was to avoid formal censorship by adhering to a voluntary code, a strategy backed by Sol Starr and most other Hollywood bigshots. They entered a living room that was extremely fancy, much more so than the spacious apartment in Buffalo, where Greg and his mother lived, and which Greg had always thought to be luxurious. This room had spindly-legged furniture that Greg imagined to be French, rich chestnut-brown velvet drapes at the windows, and a large phonograph. In the middle of the room, he was stunned to see, sitting on a yellow silk sofa, the movie star, Gladys Angelus. People said she was the most beautiful woman in the world. Greg could see why. She radiated sex appeal, from her dark blue inviting eyes to the long legs crossed under her clinging skirt. As she put out a hand to shake, her red lips smiled and her round breasts moved alluringly inside a soft sweater. He hesitated a split second before shaking her hand. He felt disloyal to his mother, Marga. She never mentioned the name of Gladys Angelus,
a sure sign that she knew what people were saying about Gladys and Lev. Greg felt he was making friends with his mother's enemy. If Mom knew about this, she would cry, he thought. But he had been taken by surprise. If he had been forewarned, if he had had time to think about his reaction, he might have prepared and rehearsed a gracious withdrawal. But he could not bring himself to be clumsily rude to this overwhelmingly lovely woman. So he took her hand, looked into her amazing eyes, and gave what people called a shit-eating grin. She kept hold of his hand as she said, "I'm so happy to meet you at long last. Your father has told me all about you, but he didn't say how handsome you are." There was something unpleasantly proprietorial about this, as if she were a member of the family, rather than a whore who had usurped his mother. All the same, he found himself falling under her spell. "I love your films," he said awkwardly. "Oh, stop it. You don't have to say that," she said. But Greg thought she liked to hear it all the same. "Come and sit by me," she went on. "I want to get to know you." He did as he was told. He could not help himself. Gladys asked him what school he attended, and while he was telling her, the phone rang. He vaguely heard his father say into the phone, "It was supposed to be tomorrow." "Okay. If we have to, we can rush it. Leave it with me. I'll handle it." Lev hung up and interrupted Gladys. "Your room is down the hall, Greg," he said. He handed over a key. "And you'll find the gift from me. Settle in and enjoy yourself. We'll meet for dinner at 7. This was abrupt, and Gladys looked put out, but Lev could be peremptory sometimes, and it was best just to obey. Greg took the key and left. In the corridor was a broad-shouldered man in a cheap suit. He reminded Greg of Joe Brekunov, head of security at the Buffalo Metalworks. Greg nodded, and the man said, "Good afternoon, sir." Presumably, he was a hotel employee. Greg entered his room. It was pleasant enough, though not as swanky as his father's suite. He did not see the gift his father had mentioned, but his suitcase was there, and he began to unpack, thinking about Gladys. Was he being disloyal to his mother by shaking hands with his father's mistress? Of course, Gladys was only doing what Marga herself had done, sleeping with a married man. All the same, he felt painfully uncomfortable. Was he going to tell his mother that he had met Gladys? Hell no. As he was hanging up his shirts, he heard a knock. It came from a door that looked as if it might lead to the neighboring room. Next moment the door opened and a girl walked through. She was older than Greg, but not much. Her skin was the color of dark chocolate, and she wore a polka dot dress and carried a clutch bag. She smiled broadly, showing white teeth, and said, "Hello, I've got the room next door." "I figured that out," he said. "Who are you?" "Jackie Jakes." She held out her hand. "I'm an actress." Greg shook hands with the second beautiful actress in an hour. Jackie had a playful look that Greg found more attractive than Gladys's overpowering magnetism. Her mouth was a dark pink bow. He said, "My dad said he got me a gift. Are you it?" She giggled. "I guess I am. He said I would like you. He's going to get me into the movies." Greg got the picture. His father had guessed he might feel bad about being friendly with Gladys. Jackie was his reward for not making a fuss. He thought he probably ought to reject such a bribe, but he could not resist. "You're a very nice gift," he said.
"Your father's real good to you."
"He's wonderful," Greg said. "And so are you."
"Aren't you sweet?"
She put her purse down on the dresser, stepped closer to Greg, stood on tiptoe, and kissed his mouth. Her lips were soft and warm.
"I like you," she said.
She felt his shoulders.
"You're strong."
"I play ice hockey."
"Makes a girl feel safe."
She put both hands on his cheeks and kissed him again, longer. Then she sighed and said,
"Oh, boy, I think we're going to have fun."
"Are we?" Washington was a southern city, still largely segregated. In Buffalo, white and black people could eat in the same restaurants and drink in the same bars, mostly. But here it was different. Greg was not sure what the laws were,
but he felt certain that in practice, a white man with a black woman would cause trouble. It was surprising to find Jackie occupying a room in this hotel. Lev must have fixed it. But there was certainly no question of Greg and Jackie swanning around town with Lev and Gladys in a foursome. So what did Jackie think they were going to do to have fun together? The amazing notion crossed his mind that she might be willing to go to bed with him. He put his hands on her waist to draw her to him for another kiss, but she pulled back.
"I need to take a shower," she said. "Give me a few minutes."
She turned and disappeared through the communicating door, closing it behind her. He sat on the bed, trying to take it all in. Jackie wanted to act in movies, and it seemed she was willing to use sex to advance her career. She certainly was not the first actress, black or white, to use that strategy. Gladys was doing the same by sleeping with Lev. Greg and his father were the lucky beneficiaries. He saw that she had left her clutch bag behind. He picked it up and tried the door. It was not locked. He stepped through. She was on the phone, wearing a pink bathrobe. She said, "Yes, hunky-dory, no problem." Her voice seemed different, more mature, and he realized that with him she had been using a sexy little girl tone that was not natural. Then she saw him, smiled, and reverted to the girly voice, as she said into the phone, "Please hold my calls. I don't want to be disturbed. Thank you. Goodbye."
"You left this," said Greg, and handed her the purse.
"You just wanted to see me in my bathrobe," she said coquettishly.
The front of the robe did not entirely hide her breasts, and he could see an enchanting curve of flawless brown skin. He grinned.
"No, but I'm glad I did."
"Go back to your room. I have to shower. I might let you see more later."
"Oh my God," he said.
He returned to his room. This was astonishing.
"I might let you see more later,"
he repeated to himself aloud. What a thing for a girl to say. He had a hard-on, but he did not want to jerk off when the real thing seemed so close. To take his mind off it, he went on unpacking. He had an expensive shaving kit, a razor and brush with pearl handles, a present from his mother. He laid the things out in the bathroom, wondering whether they would impress Jackie if she saw them. The walls were thin, and he heard the sound of running water from the next room. The thought of her body naked and wet possessed him. He tried to concentrate on arranging his underwear and socks in a drawer. Then he heard her scream. He froze. For a moment he was too surprised to move. What did it mean? Why would she yell out like that? Then she screamed again, and he was shocked into action. He threw open the communicating door and stepped into her room. She was naked. He had never seen a naked woman in real life. She had pointed breasts with dark brown tips. At her groin was a thatch of wiry black hair. She was cowering back against the wall, trying ineffectually to cover her nakedness with her hands. Standing in front of her was Dave Rusrock, with twin scratches down his aristocratic cheek, presumably caused by Jackie's pink-varnished nails. There was blood on the broad lapel of Dave's double-breasted white jacket. Jackie screamed, "Get him away from me!" Greg swung a fist. Dave was an inch taller, but he was an old man, and Greg was an athletic teenager. The blow connected with Dave's chin, more by luck than by judgment, and Dave staggered back, then fell to the floor. The room door opened. The broad-shouldered hotel employee Greg had seen earlier came in. He must have a master key, Greg thought.
"I'm Tom Cranmer, house detective," the man said. "What's going on here?"
Greg said, "I heard her scream and came in to find him here." Jackie said, "He tried to rape me."
Dave struggled to his feet.
"That's not true," he said. "I was asked to come to this room for a meeting with Saul Starr."
Jackie began to sob.
"Oh, now he's going to lie about it."
Cranmer said, "Put something on, please, miss." Jackie put on her pink bathrobe. The detective picked up the room phone, dialed a number and said,
"There's usually a cop on the corner. Get him into the lobby right now."
Dave was staring at Greg.
"You're Peshkov's bastard, aren't you?"
Greg was about to hit him again. Dave said,
"Oh my God."
This is a setup.
Greg was thrown by this remark. He felt intuitively that Dave was telling the truth. He dropped his fist.
This whole scene must have been scripted by Lev, he realized.
Dave Ruzrock was no rapist. Jackie was faking, and Greg himself was just an actor in the movie. He felt dazed.
Please come with me, sir, said Cranmer, taking Dave firmly by the arm. You two as well.
You can't arrest me, said Dave.
Yes, sir, I can, said Cranmer, and I'm going to hand you over to a police officer.
Greg said to Jackie, Do you want to get dressed? She shook her head quickly and decisively. Greg realized it was part of the plan that she would appear in her robe. He took Jackie's arm and they followed Cranmer and Dave along the corridor and into the elevator. A cop was waiting in the lobby. Both he and the hotel detective must be in on the plot, Greg surmised.
Cranmer said, I heard a scream from her room. Found the old guy in there. She says he tried to rape her. The kid is a witness.
Dave looked bewildered, as if he thought this might be a bad dream. Greg found himself feeling sorry for Dave. He had been cruelly trapped. Lev was more pitiless than Greg had imagined. Half of him admired his father, the other half wondered if such ruthlessness was really necessary. The cop snapped handcuffs on Dave and said,
All right, let's go.
Go where? Dave said.
Downtown, said the cop.
Greg said, Do we all have to go?
Yeah.
Cranmer spoke to Greg in a low voice.
Don't worry, son, he said. You did a great job. We'll go to the precinct house and make our statements, and after that you can fuck her from here to Christmas time.
The cop led Dave to the door, and the others followed. As they stepped outside, a photographer popped a flash gun. 7. Woody Doer got a copy of Freud's Studies in Hysteria mailed to him by a bookseller in New York. On the night of the Yacht Club Ball, the climactic social event of the summer season in Buffalo, he wrapped it neatly in brown paper and tied a red ribbon around it.
Chocolates for a lucky girl, said his mother, passing him in the hall.
She had only one eye, but she saw everything.
A book, he said, for Joanne Ruzrock. She won't be at the ball.
I know. Mama stopped and gave him a searching look. After a moment she said,
You're serious about her?
I guess, but she thinks I'm too young.
Her pride is probably involved. Her friends would ask why she can't find a guy her own age to go out with. Girls are cruel like that.
I'm planning to persist until she grows more mature. Mama smiled.
I bet you make her laugh.
I do. It's the best card I hold.
Well, heck, I waited long enough for your father.
Did you?
I loved him from the first time I met him. I pined for years.
I had to watch him fall for that shallow cow, Olga Vyalov, who wasn't worthy of him but had two working eyes. Thank God she got knocked up by her chauffeur.
Mother's language could be a little coarse, especially when Grandmama was not around. She had picked up bad habits during the years she spent working on newspapers.
Then he went off to war. I had to follow him to France before I could nail his foot to the goddamn floor.
Nostalgia was mixed with pain in her reminiscences, Woody could tell.
But he realized you were the right girl for him.
In the end, yes.
Maybe that'll happen to me.
Mama kissed him.
Good luck, my son, she said.
The Ruzrock house was less than a mile away, and Woody walked there. None of the Ruzrocks would be at the Yacht Club tonight. Dave had been all over the papers after a mysterious incident at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington. A typical headline had read, Cinema Mogul Accused by Starlet. Woody had recently learned to mistrust newspapers. However, gullible people said there must be something in it. Otherwise, why would the police have arrested Dave? None of the family had been seen at any social event since. Outside the house, an armed guard stopped Woody.
The family aren't seeing callers, he said brusquely.
Woody guessed the man had spent a lot of time repelling reporters, and he forgave the discourteous tone. He recalled the name of the Ruzrock's maid.
Please ask Mrs. Stella to tell Joanne that Woody Doer has a book for her.
You can leave it with me, said the guard, holding out his hand. Woody held on firmly to the book.
Thanks,
but no. The guard looked annoyed, but he walked Woody up the drive and rang the doorbell. Estella opened it and said at once,
Hello, Mr. Woody, come in. Joanne will be so glad to see you.
Woody permitted himself a triumphant glance at the guard as he stepped inside. Estella showed him into an empty drawing room. She offered him milk and cookies, as if he were still a kid, and he declined politely. Joanne came in a minute later. Her face was drawn and her olive skin looked washed out, but she smiled pleasantly at him and sat down to chat. She was pleased with the book. Now I'll have to read Dr. Freud instead of just gabbing about him, she said. You're a good influence on me, Woody.
I wish I could be a bad influence.
She let that pass. Aren't you going to the ball?
I have a ticket, but if you're not there, I'm not interested.
Would you like to go to a movie instead?
No, thanks. Really?
Or we could just get dinner, somewhere really quiet, if you don't mind taking the bus.
Oh, Woody, of course I don't mind the bus, but you're too young for me. Anyway, the summer's almost over. You'll be back at school soon, and I'm going to Vassar.
Where you'll go on dates, I guess.
I sure hope so.
Woody stood up.
Okay, well, I'm going to take a vow of celibacy and enter a monastery. Please don't come and visit me, you'll distract the other brethren.
She laughed. Thank you for taking my mind off my family's troubles.
It was the first time she had mentioned what had happened to her father. He had not been planning to raise the subject, but now that she had, he said,
You know we're all on your side. Nobody believes that actress's story. Everyone in town realizes it was a setup by that swine Lev Peshkov, and were furious about it.
I know, she said,
but the accusation alone is too shameful for my father to bear. I think my parents are going to move to Florida.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Now go to the ball.
Maybe I will.
She walked him to the door.
May I kiss you goodbye? He said.
She leaned forward and kissed his lips. This was not like the last kiss, and he knew instinctively not to grab her and press his mouth to hers. It was a gentle kiss, her lips on his for a sweet moment that was over in a breath. Then she pulled away and opened the front door.
Good night, Woody said as he stepped out.
Goodbye, said Joanne.
8. Greg Peshkov was in love. He knew that Jackie Jakes had been bought for him by his father as his reward for helping to entrap Dave Ruzrock, but despite that, it was real love. He had lost his virginity a few minutes after they returned from the precinct house, and the two of them had then spent most of a week in bed at the Ritz-Carlton. Greg did not need to use birth control, she told him, because she was already fixed up. He had only the vaguest idea what that meant, but he took her at her word. He had never been so happy in his life, and he adored her, especially when she dropped the little girl act and revealed a shrewd intelligence and a mordant sense of humor. She admitted she had seduced Greg on his father's orders, but confessed that against her will she had fallen in love. Her real name was Mabel Jakes, and although she pretended to be 19, she was in fact just 16, only a few months older than Greg. Lev had promised her a part in a movie, but, he said, he was still looking for just the right role. In a perfect imitation of Lev's vestigial Russian accent, she said, But I don't guess he's looking too fucking hard.
I guess there aren't many parts written for Negro actors, Greg said.
I know.
I'll end up playing the maid, rolling my eyes and saying, Lord,
there are Africans in plays and films, Cleopatra, Hannibal, Othello, but they're usually played by white actors.
Her father, now dead, had been a professor in a Negro college, and she knew more about literature than Greg did.
Anyway, why should Negroes only play black people? If Cleopatra can be played by a white actress, why can't Juliet be black?
People would find it strange.
People would get used to it. They get used to anything. Does Jesus have to be played by a Jew? Nobody cares.
She was right, Greg thought, but all the same it was never going to happen. When Lev had announced their return to Buffalo, leaving it until the last minute, as usual. Greg had been devastated. He had asked his father if Jackie could come to Buffalo, but Lev had laughed and said, "Son, you don't shit where you eat. You can see her next time you come to Washington." Despite that, Jackie had followed him to Buffalo a day later and moved into a cheap apartment near Canal Street. Lev and Greg had been busy for the next couple of weeks with the takeover of Rose Rock Theatres. Dave had sold for $2 million in the end, a quarter of the original offer, and Greg's admiration for his father went up another notch. Jackie had withdrawn her charges and hinted to the newspapers that she had accepted a cash settlement. Greg was awestruck by his father's callous nerve. And he had Jackie. He told his mother he was out every night with male friends, but in fact he spent all his spare time with Jackie. He showed her around town, picnicked with her at the beach, even managed to take her out in a borrowed speedboat. No one connected her with the rather blurred newspaper photograph of a girl walking out of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in a bathrobe. But mostly they spent the warm summer evenings having sweaty, deliriously happy sex, tangling the worn sheets on the narrow bed in her small apartment. They decided to get married as soon as they were old enough. Tonight, he was taking her to the Yacht Club ball. It had been extraordinarily difficult to get tickets, but Greg had bribed a school friend. He had bought Jackie a new dress, pink satin. He got a generous allowance from Marga, and Lev loved to slip him $50 now and again, so he always had more money than he needed. In the back of his mind, a warning was sounding. Jackie would be the only Negro at the ball not serving drinks. She was very reluctant to go, but Greg had talked her around. The young men would envy him, but the older ones might be hostile, he knew. There would be some muttering. Jackie's beauty and charm would overcome much prejudice, he felt. How could anyone resist her? But if some fool got drunk and insulted her, Greg would teach him a lesson with both fists. Even as he thought this, he heard his mother telling him not to be a love-struck fool. But a man could not go through life listening to his mother. As he walked along Canal Street in white tie and tails, he looked forward to seeing her in the new dress, and maybe kneeling to lift the hem up until he could see her panties and garter belt. He entered her building, an old house now subdivided. There was a threadbare red carpet on the stairs and a smell of spicy cooking. He let himself into the apartment with his own key. The place was empty. That was odd. Where would she go without him? With fear in his heart, he opened the closet. The pink satin ball dress hung there on its own. Her other clothes were gone. "No," he said aloud. "How could this happen?" On the rickety pine table was an envelope. He picked it up and saw his name on the front in Jackie's neat schoolgirl handwriting. A feeling of dread came over him. He tore open the envelope with shaky hands and read the short message. "My darling Greg, the last 3 weeks have been the happiest time of my entire life. I knew in my heart that we couldn't ever get married, but it was nice to pretend. You are a lovely boy, and will grow into a fine man, if you don't take after your father too much." Had Lev found out that Jackie was living here and somehow made her leave? He would not do that, would he? "Goodbye, and don't forget me. Your gift, Jackie." Greg crumpled the paper and wept. 9. "You look wonderful," Ava Rothman said to Daisy Peshkov. "If I was a boy, I'd fall in love with you in a minute." Daisy smiled. Ava was already a little bit in love with her, and Daisy did look wonderful in an ice blue silk organdy ball gown that deepened the blue of her eyes. The skirt of the dress had a frilled hem that was ankle length in front, but rose playfully to mid-calf behind, giving a tantalizing glimpse of Daisy's legs in sheer stockings. She wore a sapphire necklace of her mother's. "Your father bought me that back in the days when he was still occasionally nice to me," Olga said. "But hurry up, Daisy, you're making us all late." Olga was wearing matronly navy blue, and Ava was in red, which suited her dark coloring. Daisy walked down the stairs on a cloud of happiness. They stepped out of the house. Henry, the gardener, doubling as chauffeur tonight, opened the doors of the shiny old black Stutz. This was Daisy's big night. Tonight Charlie Farquharson would formally propose to her. He would offer her a diamond ring that was a family heirloom. She had seen and approved it, and it had been altered to fit her. She would accept his proposal, and then they would announce their engagement to everyone at the ball. She got into the car, feeling like Cinderella. Only Ava had expressed doubts.
"I thought you'd go for someone who was more of a match for you," she had said.
"You mean a man who won't let me boss him around?" Daisy had replied.
"No, but someone more like you, good-looking and charming and sexy."
This was unusually sharp for Ava. It implied that Charlie was homely and charmless and unglamorous. Daisy had been taken aback and did not know how to reply. Her mother had saved her. Olga had said, "I married a man who was good-looking and charming and sexy, and he made me utterly miserable." Ava had said no more. As the car approached the yacht club, Daisy vowed to restrain herself. She must not show how triumphant she felt. She must act as if there was nothing unexpected about her mother being asked to join the Buffalo Ladies' Society. As she showed the other girls her enormous diamond, she would be so gracious as to declare that she did not deserve someone as wonderful as Charlie. She had plans to make him even more wonderful. As soon as the honeymoon was over, she and Charlie would start building their stable of racehorses. In 5 years, they would be entering the most prestigious races around the world: Saratoga Springs, Longchamp, Royal Ascot. Summer was turning to fall, and it was dusk when the car drew up at the pier.
"I'm afraid we may be very late tonight, Henry," Daisy said gaily.
"Quite all right, Miss Daisy," he replied. He adored her. "You have a wonderful time now." At the door, Daisy noticed Victor Dixon following them in. Feeling well disposed toward everyone, she said,
"So, Victor, your sister met the King of England. Congratulations."
Yes, he said, looking embarrassed. They entered the club. The first person they saw was Ursula Duer, who had agreed to accept Olga into her snobby club. Daisy smiled warmly at her and said,
"Good evening, Mrs. Duer."
Ursula seemed distracted.
"Excuse me just a moment," she said,
and moved away across the lobby. She thought herself a queen, Daisy reflected, but did that mean she had no need of good manners? One day Daisy would rule over Buffalo society, but she would be unfailingly gracious to all, she vowed. The three women went into the ladies' room, where they checked their appearance in the mirrors, in case anything had gone wrong in the 20 minutes since they left home. Dot Renshaw came in, looked at them, and went out again.
"Stupid girl,"
Daisy said, but her mother looked worried.
"What's happening?"
she said. "We've been here 5 minutes, and already three people have snubbed us."
"Jealousy,"
Daisy said. "Dot would like to marry Charlie herself." Olga said, "At this point, Dot Renshaw would like to marry more or less anybody, I guess."
"Come on, let's enjoy ourselves," said Daisy, and she led the way out.
As she entered the ballroom, Woody Duer greeted her.
"At last, a gentleman," Daisy said.
In a lowered voice, he said, "I just want to say that I think it's wrong of people to blame you for anything your father might have done."
"Especially when they all bought their bows from him," she replied.
Then she saw her future mother-in-law in a ruched pink gown that did nothing for her angular figure. Nora Farquharson was not ecstatic about her son's choice of bride, but she had accepted Daisy and had been charming to Olga when they had exchanged visits.
"Mrs. Farquharson," Daisy said, "what a lovely dress."
Nora Farquharson turned her back and walked away. Ava gasped. A feeling of horror came over Daisy. She turned back to Woody.
"This isn't about bootlegging, is it?"
"No."
"What then?"
"You must ask Charlie. Here he comes." Charlie was perspiring, though it was not warm.
"What's going on?" Daisy asked him. "Everyone's giving me the cold shoulder."
He was terribly nervous.
"People are so angry at your family," he said.
"What for?"
she cried. Several people nearby heard her raised voice and looked around. She did not care. Charlie said,
"Your father ruined Dave Rusrock."
Are you talking about that incident in the Ritz-Carlton? What has that got to do with me?
Everyone likes Dave, even though he's Persian or something, and they don't believe he would rape anybody.
I never said he did.
I know,
Charlie said. He was clearly in agony. People were frankly staring now. Victor Dixon, Dot Renshaw, Chuck Doerr. Daisy said to Charlie,
But I'm going to be blamed.
Is that so?
Your father did a terrible thing.
Daisy was cold with fear. Surely she could not lose her triumph at the last minute.
Charlie,
she said,
what are you telling me? Talk straight for the love of God.
Ava put her arm around Daisy's waist in a gesture of support. Charlie replied,
Mother says it's unforgivable.
What does that mean, unforgivable?
He stared miserably at her. He could not bring himself to speak. But there was no need. She knew what he was going to say.
It's over, isn't it?
She said.
You're jilting me.
He nodded. Olga said,
Daisy, we must leave.
She was in tears. Daisy looked around. She tilted her chin as she stared them all down. Dot Renshaw, looking maliciously pleased, Victor Dixon admiring, Chuck Doerr with his mouth open in adolescent shock, and his brother Woody looking sympathetic.
To hell with you all, Daisy said loudly. I'm going to London to dance with the king.
Chapter 3, 1936. It was a sunny Saturday afternoon in May 1936, and Lloyd Williams was at the end of his second year at Cambridge, when fascism reared its vile head among the white stone cloisters of the ancient university. Lloyd was at Emmanuel College, known as Emma, doing modern languages. He was studying French and German, but he preferred German. As he immersed himself in the glories of German culture, reading Goethe, Schiller, Heine, and Thomas Mann, he looked up occasionally from his desk in the quiet library to watch with sadness as today's Germany descended into barbarism. Then the local branch of the British Union of Fascists announced that their leader, Sir Oswald Mosley, would address a meeting in Cambridge. The news took Lloyd back to Berlin 3 years earlier. He saw again the brown-shirt thugs wrecking Maud von Ulrich's magazine office, heard again the grating sound of Hitler's hate-filled voice as he stood in the Parliament and poured scorn on democracy, shuddered anew at the memory of the dog's bloody muzzle savaging Jörg with a bucket over his head. Now Lloyd stood on the platform at Cambridge Railway Station, waiting to meet his mother off the train from London. With him was Ruby Carter, a fellow activist in the local Labour Party. She had helped him organize today's meeting on the subject of the truth about fascism. Lloyd's mother, F. Leckwith, was to speak. Her book about Germany had been a big success. She had stood for Parliament again in the 1935 election, and she was once again the member for Aldgate. Lloyd was tense about the meeting. Mosley's new political party had gained many thousands of members, due in part to the enthusiastic support of the Daily Mail, which had run the infamous headline, Hurrah for the Blackshirts. Mosley was a charismatic speaker, and would undoubtedly recruit new members today. It was vital that there should be a bright beacon of reason to contrast with his seductive lies. However, Ruby was chatty. She was complaining about the social life of Cambridge.
I'm so bored with local boys, she said. All they want to do is go to a pub and get drunk.
Lloyd was surprised. He had imagined that Ruby had a well-developed social life. She wore inexpensive clothes that were always a bit tight, showing off her plump curves. Most men would find her attractive, he thought.
What do you like to do?
He asked, apart from organized Labour Party meetings.
I love dancing.
You can't be short of partners. There are 12 men for every woman at the university.
No offense intended, but most of the university men are pansies.
There were a lot of homosexual men in Cambridge University, Lloyd knew, but it startled him to hear her mention the subject. Ruby was famously blunt, but this was shocking even from her. He had no idea how to respond, so he said nothing. Ruby said,
You're not one of them, are you?
No, don't be ridiculous. No need to be insulted. You're handsome enough for a pansy, except for that squashed nose.
He laughed. That's what they call a backhanded compliment.
You are, though. You look like Douglas Fairbanks, Jr.
Well, thanks, but I'm not a pansy.
Have you got a girlfriend?
This was becoming embarrassing.
No, not at the moment.
He made a show of checking his watch and looking for the train.
Why not?
I just haven't met Miss Wright.
Oh, thank you very much, I'm sure.
He looked at her. She was only half joking. He felt mortified that she had taken his remark personally.
I didn't mean... Yes, you did. But never mind. Here's the train.
The locomotive drew into the station and came to a halt in a cloud of steam. The doors opened and passengers stepped out onto the platform. Students in tweed jackets, farmers' wives going shopping, working men in flat caps. Lloyd scanned the crowd for his mother.
She'll be in a third-class carriage, he said, matter of principle.
Ruby said, would you come to my 21st birthday party?
Of course.
My friend's got a little flat in Market Street, and a deaf landlady. Lloyd was not comfortable about this invitation, and hesitated over his reply. Then his mother appeared, as pretty as a songbird in a red summer coat and a jaunty little hat. She hugged and kissed him.
You look very well, my lovely, she said, but I must buy you a new suit for next term. This one is fine, ma'am.
He had a scholarship that paid his university fees and basic living expenses, but it did not run to suits. When he started at Cambridge, his mother had dipped into her savings and bought him a tweed suit for daytime and an evening suit for formal dinners. He had worn the tweed every day for 2 years, and it showed. He was particular about his appearance and made sure he always had a clean white shirt, a perfectly knotted tie, and a folded white handkerchief in his breast pocket. There had to be a dandy somewhere in his ancestry. The suit was carefully pressed, but it was beginning to look shabby, and in truth he longed for a new one, but he did not want his mother to spend her savings.
We'll see, she said.
She turned to Ruby, smiled warmly and held out her hand.
I'm Eth Leckwith,
she said with the easy grace of a visiting duchess.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Ruby Carter. Are you a student too, Ruby?
No, I'm a maid at Chimbley, a big country house.
Ruby looked a bit ashamed as she made this confession.
It's 5 miles out of town, but I can usually borrow a bike.
Fancy that, said Ethel. When I was your age, I was a maid at a country house in Wales.
Ruby was amazed.
You? A housemaid? And now you're a member of Parliament?
That's what democracy means.
Lloyd said, Ruby and I organized today's meeting together. His mother said, and how is it going?
Sold out. In fact, we had to move to a bigger hall.
I told you it would work.
The meeting was Ethel's idea. Ruby Carter and many others in the Labour Party had wanted to mount a protest demonstration, marching through the town. Lloyd had agreed at first.
Fascism must be publicly opposed at every opportunity, he had said.
Ethel had counseled otherwise.
If we march and shout slogans, we look just like them, she had said. Show that we're different. Hold a quiet, intelligent meeting to discuss the reality of fascism.
Lloyd had been dubious.
I'll come and speak if you like, she had said.
Lloyd had put that to the Cambridge party. There had been a lively discussion, with Ruby leading the opposition to Ethel's plan. But in the end, the prospect of having an MP and famous feminist to speak had clinched it. Lloyd was still not sure it had been the right decision. He recalled Maud von Ulrich in Berlin saying, "We must not meet violence with violence." That had been the policy of the German Social Democratic Party. For the von Ulrich family and for Germany, the policy had been a catastrophe. They walked out through the yellow brick Romanesque arches of the station and hurried along leafy Station Road, a street of smug middle-class houses made of the same yellow brick. Ethel put her arm through Lloyd's.
How's my little undergraduate, then? She said.
He smiled at the word little. He was 4 inches taller than she, and muscular because of his training with the university boxing team. He could have picked her up with one hand. She was bursting with pride, he knew. Few things in life had pleased her as much as his coming to this place. That was probably why she wanted to buy him suits.
"I love it here, you know that," he said. "I love it more when it's full of working-class boys."
"And girls," Ruby put in. They turned into Hills Road, the main thoroughfare leading to the town centre. Since the coming of the railway, the town had expanded south toward the station, and churches had been built along Hills Road to serve the new suburb. Their destination was a Baptist chapel whose left-wing pastor had agreed to loan it free of charge.
"I've made a bargain with the fascists," Lloyd said. "I said we'd refrain from marching if they would promise to do the same."
"I'm surprised they agreed," said Ethel. "Fascists love marching."
"They were reluctant, but I told the university authorities and the police what I was proposing, and the fascists pretty much had to go along with it."
"That was clever."
"But, ma'am, guess who is their local leader?"
"Viscount Aberowen, otherwise known as Boy Fitzherbert, the son of your former employer, Earl Fitzherbert."
Boy was 21, the same age as Lloyd. He was at Trinity, the aristocratic college.
"What? My God."
She seemed more shaken than he had expected, and he glanced at her. She had gone pale.
"Are you shocked?"
"Yes."
She seemed to recover her composure.
"His father is a junior minister in the Foreign Office."
The government was a conservative-dominated coalition.
"Fitz must be embarrassed."
"Most conservatives are soft on fascism, I imagine. They see little wrong with killing communists and persecuting Jews."
"Some of them, perhaps. But you exaggerate."
She gave Lloyd a sideways look.
"So you went to see Boy?"
"Yes."
Lloyd thought this seemed to have special significance for Ethel, but he could not imagine why. "I thought him perfectly frightful. In his room at Trinity he had a whole case of scotch, 12 bottles.
"You met him once before. Do you remember?"
"No. When was that?"
"You were 9 years old. I took you to the Palace of Westminster shortly after I was elected. We met Fitz and Boy on the stairs."
Lloyd did vaguely remember. Then, as now, the incident seemed to be mysteriously important to his mother.
"That was him? How funny."
Ruby put in,
"I know him. He's a pig. He paws maids."
Lloyd was shocked, but his mother seemed unsurprised.
"Very unpleasant, but it happens all the time."
Her grim acceptance made it more horrifying to him. They reached the chapel and went in through the back door. There, in a kind of vestry, was Robert von Ulrich, looking startlingly British in a bold green and brown check suit and a striped tie. He stood up and Ethel hugged him. In faultless English, Robert said, "My dear Ethel, what a perfectly charming het." Lloyd introduced his mother to the local Labour Party women who were preparing urns of tea and plates of biscuits to be served after the meeting. Having heard Ethel complain many times that people who organized political events seemed to think an MP never needed to go to the toilet, he said,
"Ruby, before we start, would you show my mother where the ladies' facilities are?"
The two women went off. Lloyd sat down next to Robert and said conversationally,
"How's business?"
Robert was now the proprietor of a restaurant much favored by the homosexuals about whom Ruby had been complaining. Somehow he had known that Cambridge in the 1930s was congenial to such men, just as Berlin had been in the 1920s. His new place had the same name as the old, Bistro Robert.
"Business is good," he answered.
A shadow crossed his face, a brief but intense look of real fear.
"This time, I hope I can keep what I've built up."
"We're doing our best to fight off the fascists, and meetings such as this are the way to do it," Lloyd said.